Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam, the luckiest thing about having a podcast is you get to invite people on who you respect and enjoy and like. And Chris and I met a couple of years ago at, we were both getting new reels ready, new sizzle reels ready for our speaking careers. And so we spent 2 days in a branding workshop online, like all day, 2 days straight. And it was a group of only six people. So we talked about each other's work incessantly. It was really wild. But since then, I've been like hashtag slightly obsessed with Chris's work. I think it's really important. I really like the way he approaches leadership and culture transformation. So today, because he's releasing a book, I get to bring him on and you get to learn from him, which is lucky for you. Chris Pineda is an organizational leadership psychologist, speaker, and founder of Groundwork Leadership. His work blends modern psychology, community transformation, and indigenous Filipino wisdom. He created the Seven Conditions of Transformation and Culture of One frameworks, and his upcoming book, Beneath the Transaction, Write That Shit Down, explores what truly drives change in people and organizations. With over a decade of experience coaching leaders and serving in healthcare leadership, Chris helps organizations build cultures rooted in trust, purpose, and human development.
All
Chris,
right.
Welcome to Fried.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm excited. So excited that you're here. We're going to go right to the heart of it. One of the first things that you talk about is moving from transactional leadership to transformational leadership. Let's go down. What the heck? What are you, transactional leadership? Let's get a definition.
Yeah. You know, transactional leadership is going through the motions. It's checking the boxes. It's kind of doing what's expected. And that's in life and leadership. It, you know, we do it in life. We go through the motions, we check the boxes, and then years go by and we wonder what happened with life. We do the same thing at work. And in fact, we create habits and routines and systems and process to keep transaction moving. And to transactions defense, we need it in a lot of ways in life. We need transaction, but our hearts and our souls and our relationships, they long for transformation. We want to feel something deeper. We want to connect. We want to have meaning. We want to have purpose. And that's all in the world of transformation. That happens beneath the surface, in my opinion. So I think no matter if we're thinking of our life or our work life, our leadership, I think those things apply. And I've been pretty obsessed with this idea of transformation for a long time. It took me a few years to realize that, man, there's an enemy to transformation, and it's transaction. And gosh, it's everywhere. And I had to see that in myself first before I could, you know, start to influence others around the idea. But
so when I think of transaction, one of the things that I'm thinking about is I hold a really deep belief personally that reciprocity is not what I need. So I don't believe that I do this for you, for instance, and then when I release a book, you do it for me. You can, that would be fine and it would be lovely, but that's not the point. So to me, reciprocity energetically works on a different level. Like I provide this thing. I give something of myself because I want to, because it's interesting for me. And I get that energy back in some way, shape, or form, possibly unrecognizable to me and possibly from a different source. So I always believe that the things I'm putting out there are coming back to me in some way, shape, or form, just not necessarily the expected way. So when I think of transaction, I'm thinking of people who are putting stuff out there and sharing stuff with each other for that reciprocity. Like, I do this, which means you do that, and then we all move forward. Is that part of your definition of transaction?
Yeah, I think the one word to put it simply is an exchange. You know, there's an exchange, a transactional exchange, where I'm engaging in this interaction, this relationship, because you do this and I do that. And again, some of us will think that's totally normal. That's what we do. But that, I would say, that is what transaction tells us. We need this order. We need structure in our life in order to get from point A to point B. And I think that's the transactional mentality that's important. But if it consumes our mind, that's all it becomes. Transformation doesn't need order. It doesn't need this perfect thing to have. It doesn't care about any of that. It kind of transcends time and space. It just is. And to me, transformation, to give the opposite definition of transaction, transformation is a fundamental shift towards our positive potential. And that might be in how we see, that might be in how we think or how we behave. And those shifts happen, and those are moments of transformation. But honestly, it's a journey. And I say all the time, it's a journey, not a destination, transformation. So
would you say that it's dangerous for somebody to be in a workplace and be going to work every day and saying, like, I just do this job for the paycheck?
Well, I would say that a lot of people live that way. And some, you know, I'll start at the extremes, right? Some people, they're just trying to survive and they don't have the luxury of thinking beyond, I just need my basic needs are needing to be met. And I get that, right? But we've even seen some people that have had the worst cards dealt to them that are able to transcend that and see beyond it. And so it is possible, right? And it's a choice to me. It's a choice that we get to make. And this is where these seven conditions come into place, because transformation, it's not just this foofy thing that's out there. I mean, it happens, and we can enter this journey to it. And these seven conditions came from research that I did. I wish I came up with them. You know, my bio says Chris created these. I really sort of discovered them from research, formal academic research that I was doing. And there was just seven conditions, themes that kept occurring in people's journey of transformation. So those were hard to ignore. And the first one was purpose. And if you find somebody that has really deep and meaningful purpose, especially purpose born out of suffering or pain, it doesn't matter what cards they're dealt, they're going to transcend that because they've discovered something, perhaps in the depths of that struggle, that's going to help them move beyond that. And that's the first condition of transformation. If someone has, or someone, an organization, you name it, a family, a marriage, if they have a deeper purpose that's stated and intentional, that sets them on the trajectory of being on the journey of transformation, from what I've seen.
Does the purpose in that scenario, so if we're starting with purpose, we're jumping right in, we're at purpose, does that purpose have to have an emotional component to it? Because some people will be like, well, my purpose is making money, honey.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, like, it does.
Yes. Yes. And I would say there's transactional purposes, right? There's a purpose or something that's above the surface. And the here's the way to put it, right? There's a difference also between change and transformation. And change has parameters. It can be orchestrated. You can get compliance, and you can follow a set of rules, and change might occur. But transformation doesn't have those sort of boundaries or parameters. So that's one thing to kind of, I guess, you know, put in the parking lot, our mental parking lot. But to answer your question, I mean, absolutely. And I'm definitely not the only person or the first that has talked about this. One of my favorite authors and probably one of the most influential people to me, never met, you know, they're before my time. Viktor Frankl, survived a Holocaust survivor, really put logotherapy on the map, which is therapy through finding meaning in suffering. And he talks about, and I mentioned these three things in my book as well, when I'm talking about purpose, it's three forms and we'll use these terms, purpose, why, meaning, interchangeably, right? They're all different vantage points of the same thing, right? Your purpose is this thing that you've thought of to put out into the world, and your actions and your behaviors and your thought process follow it. And your why statement that you have maybe defines it, but it all kind of comes from this deeper meaning. You know, people are searching for meaning. One of Frankl's most popular books is called Man's Search for Meaning. And he talks about three types of meaning. And the first is, I think, what you mentioned, it's having a work to do. So if we have a job, a task, something that we're going after, something that's concrete, right? Making a lot of money is concrete. And I would say, okay, well, when you make a lot of money, then what, right? It's fixed. It's an accomplishment. And having a work to do can change. And he talks about that, you know, everybody had a job and everybody had a work to do. And then he was thrown into the camps, and he talks about in his book, he was literally stripped down to nothing. And so they take everything from you. And so having a work to do no longer was any form of meaning. But then, you know, they put you to work and they had them build, you know, build roads and do all sorts of stuff in these camps, and they all had different responsibilities. So sure, they had a work to do there, but the next day it could change. So they couldn't rely on a steady work to do to provide meaning. It could be ripped from them at any moment. The second type of meaning he talks about is much deeper, and it's human connection. You know, we have connections, we have families, we have relationships, and those are very important to us. In fact, if you ask me some of the most important parts of my purpose and my why, I would include my family. But he also saw in the extreme circumstances that your connections and relationships can be taken from you. His wife died, his parents died in the camps, even relationships he talks about that he'd have people in the bunk next to him. They would be dead the next morning. So these human connections also are not enough to rely on. And you'll notice that human connection and having a work to do are both outside of us. So what we're doing there is we're giving our power of our purpose to something outside of ourselves, and we rely on that. So what if that thing disappears? What if I don't make a bunch of money? What if life changes? Then I become broken, right? And one of my best friends, CEO of Thread Wallets, he had a saying once that I love. He said, I gotta have a shallow rock bottom. And we will have an endless rock bottom if we put our purpose and meaning in things outside of ourselves. So the last form of meaning. So we've talked about three, a work to do, human connection. The third Frankl talks about is suffering. And for him, he attributes a lot of his survival to multiple things, but that's really the heart of it, was he was able to find meaning in the suffering in the moment. And then looking back, he was able to find meaning, you know, in the suffering he had gone through. And when he looked around at the very few that survived as well, they were able to find meaning even in their deepest suffering. And that's where sort of purpose born out of pain comes from. And the difference between that versus the other two is that's within ourselves, is we can control our response and attitude toward suffering. And suffering could be as severe as what he went through, or they could be as simple as we had a bad day today. And if we can find meaning in those things, especially those low moments, and pull purpose out of that and connect that to our why, then we become a bit unstoppable. And that's hard to do. Most people aren't reflective enough to think that way. They certainly have the ability, but nobody asks us those questions. Nobody says, well, you know, what are some of the most difficult things that you've been through, and how has that made you who you are today? We don't often think about that. In fact, we resent and we're bitter about the things that happened to us, the way people have wronged us, the things that didn't go well. And it takes a really intentional effort to see that actually I'm better because of that, and I learned from that, and that's contributed to this new meaning that I have in my life, and nobody can take that from me. So that is kind of the heart of of purpose. And I hope that answers your question, because there is a difference between having purpose. Well, I want to make a lot of money and I want to, or, you know, and people can have bad purposes too. They can fixate their mind on doing harm to other people. But again, what we're talking about here is the sort of purpose that contributes to these fundamental shifts towards our positive potential. And I know I'm rambling a lot, I apologize, but one last thing to this, and I mentioned sort of the accomplishment pursuits versus what I call the becoming, right? We set accomplishment goals and things that we want to do. And I think we have that in reverse, because too often I say, well, I want to do this thing, I want to accomplish this thing in my life. And then I'm not always happy with what I become as a result of it, because maybe I manipulated people, I lied, cheated, stealed in some way. And maybe I accomplished this thing, you know, I made 10 million bucks, let's say, whatever. Great. But what did I become as a result? Versus what I ask leaders that I work with to do is kind of reverse those two things, is create becoming goals. What do you want to become? Because becoming and transformation are synonymous almost. When we're becoming something, we're in the journey of transformation. And so I can be proud of who I become. That I want to become the sort of person that can do hard things. I want to become the sort of person that can forgive another individual. I want to become this, you know, I set these goals of becoming a better person, and I'm going to accomplish amazing things in that pursuit. But those things stick with us. These things are fleeting. You know, once I do it, it's over, and then I'm on to the next, which is great. That's part of goal setting. But we can't forget the becoming part of goal setting, and we have to be in tune with that. And I would say that's the difference between, again, going back to how we started, difference between transaction and transformation.
And so one of the things that you talk about is that transformation in an organization starts with the leader. And I think what you're saying now is really closely related to that. Like, if the leader is not on board with having their own transformative process, it's really difficult to then transform a culture. So when you are working with a company, are you like top down? Are you leadership first? Are you doing it at the same time? Is there a do you have to see a certain amount of transformation happen in order to feel okay going into the next stage? Mm-hmm. I know you're probably not getting questions like this most of the time, but I follow my curiosity instead of journalistic rules on this podcast.
No, these are great questions. You know, there's some characteristics of transformation, and one of them is that it starts small, but it never starts, you never start alone. And, you know, mass movements, let's say this movement of transformation in an organization, we'll say, it never starts in the masses. It starts with one person at a time. And I found out the hard way that leaders are just the best to start with, in my opinion. And I'll tell you why I think that. And I kind of fell into this passion around leadership. I was really passionate when I was younger in my career around peace building, and I still am, peace building and bringing people together and, you know, conflict resolution. And that's what I was sort of orienting my life to, and my experience, my degrees, you know, undergrad in peace building, master's in negotiation, conflict resolution. And then I got hired by this philanthropist who is in the book, and the whole arc line of the book is actually the moment that he asked me this question I'm going to share with you, and everything that came after that, and, you know, that led into my dissertation and my PhD work and all of these discoveries. But he asked me, I was working for a consulting company at the time, the Arbinger Institute, and I met these philanthropists. They were real estate guys. I didn't know they were philanthropists at first, but after I built a relationship with, I found out they're philanthropists. And I found myself, fast forwarding, I found myself sitting knee to knee with this gentleman, and he's worth a lot of money. You know, he's done well for himself, and he spends his time now giving it away, which is, you know, great for him. And he's, you know, he's a very humble person. But he asked me, he said, if you could come to our community and make a difference, you know, create transformation, you didn't have to worry about resources, what would you do? And he asked me to make a plan. And so I did. And again, fast forwarding, he said, I like it. Let's get to work. And it was a year guarantee. And that turned into many, many years working with him. But what we realized, and I fell into this leadership, this lens of leadership, because the goal was, how do we create transformational change in our community? How do we move the needle in things like graduation rates, homelessness, you know, our city's livability, all of these sort of large scale challenges? And I just realized we cannot fix those things. There's no amount of dollar that can do it. We just can't. There's no way. You know, it would take forever to make that change if we are the only ones trying to do it. And so we had this strategy of bringing sectors together. Like, well, what if our community worked together and all these organizations stopped trying to compete and they just worked with one another, and the, you know, nonprofit, for-profit, government, health, you know, education, you know, government, they just collaborated differently. And I saw this because I was sitting at tables where all these leaders were at. They're talking about a problem, let's say homelessness, but they all have a different way of describing it. You know, business thinks it's all about, you know, economics, education, thinks it's education, faith community. They talk about sin. And I mean, everybody has this different lens of why the same problems exist. And they just spend hours talking about the, you know, my friend used to call it admiring the problem. They just admire the problem. And so we realized there's nothing that we can do. There's no dollar amount that's going to fix this. We might be able to put Band-Aids on it. But it just occurred to us that if we bring the leaders of those organizations together and we help them build deep and trusting relationships with one another, if we help them move and live beneath the transaction, that will lead to them leading beneath the transaction and these organizations, you know, starting to work together, ultimately the community benefiting. And I can now sit here and say that we saw that process happen. We saw the process happening of focusing on just a handful of leaders at a time, spending enough time and consistency. That's another condition of transformation, consistency with them over time, that starts to make a difference in their organizations and then in the community. And then sooner or later, you're seeing these amazing things happen that just would never have been possible if we started off with the transaction. And I believe that a leader is critical for that piece because they're so influential. They have decision-making capabilities, they have influence, they have the relationships. There's so many reasons why, and there's good and bad leaders. So it's not to say that leaders are automatically special in some way, but I think that far too many leaders underestimate what the power that they have in their organizations to enact some incredible transformative change if they first change in here, right? And that's where it gets deep, is you can't teach transformation. You have to help people catch it. So one of my sayings is transformation's caught, not taught. So that becomes a very difficult endeavor. I can't just sit here and teach you all the things and say, well, if you just follow this formula, then tomorrow you'll see.
You'll be transformed.
It's hard. They have to catch it. So it's all about giving the best opportunities to help somebody catch transformation. And that's what we tried to do for these leaders, and we tried to help them do in their organizations. Don't just go in and use your power and start waving things around and saying that, you know, that's you might get some compliance, but compliance creates change, but compliance never creates transformation. So it became an art form almost. That's probably a better way to put it. Not necessarily a science, an art form.
So you need purpose. And there's an ebb and flow to it. And you need commitment. Those are two of the things that you need to get to sort of, you know, really work on this transformation, which is part of getting, you know, beneath the transaction, right? Like that these are all things that are connected. So you have a leader, you found the purpose, you're working with them consistently. So there's a consistency, there's a commitment to it. What else do we need to see? Like, here's, first of all, my brain wants to go bibbidi bobbidi boo, and like I feel like the fairy godmother is coming in and like bibbidi bobbidi boo. And I know that that's what you're saying, is that's what can't happen. Like, people have to have the environment, you're saying, necessary to allow for that change. And from the perspective of neuroscience and the perspective of physiology, in order to have that environment requires safety. And that's also one of the conditions, right? So I feel like the other day I went to a Barnes & Noble because I'm writing a new book too, right? And the book is for leaders and teams both. And I went to Barnes & Noble because I was like, what about, like, what is out there right now? What's current? What's happening? And I looked and I saw all of the books in the workplace sort of wellness, organizational psychology, all of that. Every single one of them is how to be a better leader. Every single one. There is not one book about how to be a better employee. It's only about being a better leader. Because, yeah, okay, I get it. I mean, they do have all this influence and they can do all of these things. But I feel like for leaders, especially right now, it's a little bit of a dangerous space to be in because everybody's got an idea about how you should be doing things better. So I think that there are a lot of leaders out there right now, and I have spoken to them, who are feeling a little defensive or feeling a little bit like, oh, really? Now you're going to transform my life so that we can like, this seems to be a big ask. And safety is a component that needs to happen. So do you find that people do feel unsafe, that there is a defensiveness to this? And how do you work with that? If you do find it, and maybe you're like, Katie, that doesn't even happen.
No, it definitely does. You know, change, again, I think we mistake transformation and change for each, you know, we call transformation change all the time, and change is a word that we use in the organizational space, and people definitely are afraid of it because, you know, nobody really likes change, but they also hate the way things are, so that creates a pretty finger pointing environment, because mm-hmm. what that means is, yeah, I don't like the way things are because all these people around me need to change, not me. And, you know, I don't want to change. That's why it's like, nobody likes change if it means I have to change, but I don't like the way things are because all these other people have to change. And that's always been a big problem in any group dynamic, whether it's, you know, two people or 500, is it takes, and this is where leadership is expands beyond a title. You know, whoever has influence is going to be the one that is the first to change. And that's how I talk about actually commitment in the book, is commitment is being committed to the things that you know are right and true. Again, stemming kind of from purpose. It's being committed and choosing again, even when you maybe have every reason not to. And that's the hard part of leadership as well, is because it's easy for leaders to look around and say, well, if all these people would change, if all these, you know, these X, Y, and Z, these employees or that or board or whatever, they're not getting it. That's probably one of the biggest traps I think leaders fall into. But I've seen something happen when a leader truly changes first internally, even when they have every reason not to, which actually makes it even more powerful, right? When you have all the excuses and justification and reason around you to say, I am not the one that needs to change here, but you dig deep enough to actually be the one to change, that creates an instant accountability and ripple effect with people around you. And that's when safety starts to be created, because now it's safe for me to make a mistake if I'm the employee. It's safe for me to own up to something that I did wrong. It's safe for me to not say something perfectly all the time. But that environment has to be catalyzed by someone. And it doesn't always have to be the leader. You could just have a really influential person that is not the title of leader that is able to create that environment. But at one way, shape, or form in a hierarchical organization, that's going to have to be supported by the actual leader, because again, they have the power dynamic, can totally change things in an instant. And this is, you know, this is one of the reasons why I, and you know this about me from that time we spent together, when I speak, I talk about this, when I consult with people, I lean into this. It's all over the book. I really learned a lot from indigenous culture, specifically from my father's side, Asia Pacific Islands. He's from the Philippines. And I wasn't taught a lot of these indigenous things growing up. You know, the Philippines is an interesting country because for the last you know, in the modern era, they've been liberated and what have you, but not for very long. And then they were under Spanish influence forever, 400 plus years. And so a lot of the culture has been lost. And so I've really taken it upon myself as an adult to study this indigenous culture. And there's so much that we can learn from these things. And there's a power behind it, because if it's 1,000 years old and it's still lasted throughout history, throughout colonization, then there's got to be something we could learn from that. And one of those things, you know, that I learned actually on my recent trip to the Philippines, you know, when they, in their tribes, when they were leading, they didn't have one specific leader. They went through a chief era called Datus, and they would have multiple chiefs, and those chiefs were responsible for different things. But you weren't a chief by birth or lineage. Like, it's not because I was from some royal bloodline that I was leading. You actually became a leader in your community by how you served those around you. That's how you earned it. And that's when people started to follow you. And everything about the culture hinged upon this connection that I have to other people and the responsibility I owe to them. And I talk about Kapwa a lot in my book, Kapwa, K-A-P-W-A, which means I am who I'm in relation to. It's this idea of collective identity. So actually there is no, there's selfish motive in us innately, but they have this sort of this cultural blockade of Kapwa that stops that selfishness to say, no, I am actually who I'm connected to. So I have to take care of those around me. And when leaders start to think that way, they start to change themselves first, because they know that that influences other people. And I have an example. Can I share a story? Is that okay?
Always.
I'm rambling, Kate. I'm so sorry.
Don't stop saying that. If I wanted to interrupt you, Chris, I would.
So, you know, a story from my dad, and this is in chapter 6 of the book. Yes, chapter 6 of the book. And just a great example to me always of someone who's changed even when they've had every reason not to. And my dad is not, you wouldn't call him, you know, well educated in the classical sense. He's an immigrant to the country. You know, he's English is his third language. He's not at like what we would call classically well-spoken. There's lots of things that you would look at him and you wouldn't think, oh, that's a leader that runs and leads organizations. He's never had super impressive titles. I mean, the guy is the salt of the earth and incredibly humble, and I'm grateful for him. He's my hero. I mean, he's taught me more than any, you know, leadership book ever has. And it started at a young age, and it was always through example. And because again, he's not super eloquent with his words, and we tease him all the time too, because he can't say certain things or pronounce things. And as kids, we just give him a hard time, and he loves it. He loves being the family's, class clown, I guess. But he, when I was young, probably 10, 11 years old, my dad worked at Ross Dress for Less. He was a manager at Ross. He worked there for a long time. And I was out with my mom running errands. She dropped me off there to wait for him because he was going to get off his shift soon. And she had to do some other things. So he knows I was there. I'm sitting in the front on the inside of the store on a little bench, you know, at the front of Ross. And when I'm sitting, he came and said, hey, I just got to finish things up and then we'll go. And as I'm sitting there, this woman comes through the sliding doors next to me, and is holding some item in her hand, very upset. I mean, just, you know, shouting, saying profanities, like just mad, demanding to speak to somebody. She just cuts in front of line of everybody, wants to speak to a manager. And so my dad, his nickname is Bong, but that's what he goes by, B-O-N-G, Bong. Filipinos are big on nicknames. So his name's Bong. They say, Bong, could you come down to the front desk? So they call the manager. And I can already tell that she's bothered by this whole situation. You know, like, this guy's name's Bong. Like, I can just tell that she's bothered. And, you know, in Ross, most Rosses either have that big center aisle down the middle or two, right? This one had the big one down the middle, and the offices are in the back. So he comes around and he's walking down. It's a long walk, right? She can see him. And I remember watching her cock her head back and roll her eyes like, oh my gosh, you know, here we go is what I imagine she's thinking. And as soon as he starts to approach and starts to say what he's going to say, trying to have good customer service, big smile on his face, she just says, I want to speak to somebody who speaks English. I want to talk to somebody who speaks English. And my dad laughs and smiles and he says, I speak English. And I remember being bothered by that. Like, yeah, my dad's got an accent, but he is intelligible. Like you, he speaks fine English, right? So I was bothered that this woman was treating him this way already. So I'm starting to get frustrated. And he's, you know, doing his thing. He's trying to be helpful and she's getting more and more upset. And finally she gets so mad that she hits her finger and she puts it right in his face. And she says, why don't you just go back to where you came from? And she wasn't talking about the back of the store and the offices. And I knew what she meant by that. And everybody in the store, there was customers watching this, other employees watching this, knew what she meant by that. And my dad knew what she meant by that. And he just smiled on his face as she said it. And I was so upset. I clenched my fists and I wanted to stand up and just charge her. Like I just wanted to rush her. But he looked over at me. He gave me this look like, it's okay, son. It'll be all right. So I sat back down and I watched him again, kindly address this woman's needs. He didn't say anything about what she said to him. He just kind of laughed it off almost like it was just nothing. And then, you know, fix solves her problem. She's satisfied with the outcome, but still upset, storms out. And then my dad comes over to me and says, hey, I'm going to grab my stuff. I'll be right back. Let me go. He doesn't say anything about what just happened. And he leaves. And I was more frustrated actually by how the whole store reacted. They didn't do anything. I was mad that nobody said anything to this woman. I was mad that nobody followed her out in the parking lot and, you know, like told her what was what. I was so upset that life just went humming as normal and this was okay for everybody. That was so irritating to me. I was getting emotional. I was like about to burst, you know, as a little kid. And my dad, you know, he finally comes and gets me and we're walking out to the car. And I think, okay, now he's going to explode. Now he's going to let me know how he really feels. Nothing. We get in the car, we start driving, still nothing. I mean, he's acting like it was a normal day. And finally, a couple minutes into the drive, I just blow up. I got tears coming down my face. You know, I'm 10, 11 years old. And I start calling this woman every bad word that I can think of. You know, words I've heard on TV, and I get maybe two sentences out before my dad abruptly turns the car off to the side of the road, and he says to me sternly, stop, Chris, stop. And he's looking straight at me, and he says, Chris, I don't want to hear you ever say those things about another person ever again. We don't speak that way. But dad, you know, no, son, I know that what you saw was probably hard to watch, but you have to understand something, Chris. That woman, you have to think this way. That woman is somebody else's mom, somebody else's daughter, somebody's wife, somebody's sister. You just have to imagine her that way. And Chris, you have a mom and you have sisters. And one day you might have a wife, and I do, right? And I have daughters, right? But at the time he's just painting this picture. And he says, would you ever want ever want anybody to speak about them that way? Of course, I said no. But he said, well, Chris, the most we can do is love people. So I'm really sorry, but that's all we can do. And then he got back on the road and we drove away. And I remember being humbled by what he said. I was still frustrated. I wanted to be mad. And frankly, I didn't really understand the lesson he was trying to teach me. You know, all I thought in that moment as I look back was, okay, say nice things about ladies. Like that was kind of his message. Say that, you know, like this is what he painted this picture. This is this woman and I shouldn't say these things. But now I look back and I'm so thankful for that moment for a lot of reasons. The first is he could have planted seeds of resentment and prejudice and everything in my heart, which he didn't. And I look back and I learned that My dad, actually, this goes to the point that I was saying of being the first to change, even when you have every reason not to. He was the only person in the story that had no reason to be the first to change. He had every reason in the book to be the most upset, to be the most bitter, to be the most resentful, but he didn't. And then he helped me see that as his son. And he helped all these onlookers also see that somebody chose another path in a very justified, against all the reason to be justified in getting angry and upset. And so I use that story in the book kind of as a more extreme, let's say, to where there's never going to be a situation as a leader where you can't dig deep enough to find a way to change. Because when you do that, you start to catalyze safety within your team or the people that you're with. You start to set a precedence that we don't have to be perfect here, and that it's okay if we make mistakes. And then if you have a whole organization or a team that all thinks about their work that way, how can I be the first to change today on my team? You've created a really accountable team, and a team that trusts, that's going to build trust. And that to me is how you start to catalyze safety, to come back to your point. Because all right, Chris, what you said is true.
I'm going to be real annoying, because I still don't have an answer for my question. So I'm going to ask it again.
Okay. Yes.
So the thing that I'm wondering is, say you're being brought into a company and you want to work with the leadership first, and they are defensive and not wanting to get into it, then what do you, like, but there is some sort of demand for transformation because they brought you in. Right. But that leader didn't bring you in. Their boss brought you in. Are you going up to their boss to start first? Are you creating safety for that leader? Like, I think one of the things, and the reason that I'm asking this so particularly and the kind of harping in on it, is if we're requiring all these leaders to do all this work and to make all this change, but I see them being defensive. I see them not wanting to do it. And it's like nice to think about, well, yeah, but if they do it, then it's lovely. Okay, cool. And if they do it, then they create safety. Okay, cool. But who's doing it for them? And how are they getting to the point where they feel okay doing it? And how are they getting to the point where they feel like this is necessary for them, right? Because there's not a lot of people walking around going, well, if I can transform, then I help everybody. Like, you know, you tend to think that either you're good enough or you're voice in your head tells you you're a shitbag no matter what you do, because we all have different, you know, different goblins in our brains that say different things. But when you, like, I know you do this work in businesses. I know you get brought in to do this with people. And so I'm guessing that sometimes there's a little bit of friction in the beginning. How do you help people get there?
Yeah. You know, I've actually felt more friction when I was the one in the chair, you know, leading an organization and trying to help department heads, you know, be the first to change. You know, and you know this, being a third party coming in, that usually kind of sends a message like, oh, hey, this is different. So people, they perk up a little bit more, and they're paying attention a little bit more. They're more receptive, at least on the surface. I never fool myself and think that everybody's going to be open, you know, beneath the surface. I think that's the nature of my work, is how do we open people beneath the surface? And there's, again, I can't force it to them. So I'm just trying to create environments to help them catch it. And so it's certain questions and that we're doing, lack of a better term, activities, exercises that we're going through that are reflective enough to help them start to see themselves as part of the problem. But it always starts with, again, somebody being the first to change and the vulnerability that's in the room. And if I'm the only one that can be that, then I'm going to be that. And so I'm going to share stories of failure, stories of when I didn't get it right, because it starts to invite in them like, okay, there's a safety here. I don't have to put on this show of I know exactly what I'm doing and I'm perfect at everything. And then it starts to become the minority then starts to become the ones that are withholding that, actually, is what I've seen. You have a room of leaders and everybody's, the minority's me being the one opening up and being vulnerable. But then after time working with them, the minority starts to be the one that's not, and they start to feel this pressure in a positive way of, okay, I better jump on this because everybody else is starting to move in that direction. And being vulnerable, which again is another condition of transformation, being vulnerable, opening the door that fear is telling us to keep shut. So some of it is really identifying what are the fears getting in the way of us just admitting that maybe we can be the first ones to change here. What's getting in the way of us just owning up that we're not doing something right now. And that's really one of the first things I say working with teams is, if things were going well, I wouldn't be here, right? So you've brought me in because things can be better and you want things to improve. So let's just get the elephant out of, let's call it out. Things are not the way that they need to be right now. So that means that things have to change. And I'm going to ask you that's going to start with us. Because if we're just expecting other people outside of this room to change, then we're going to waste our time. And I tell the same thing too when I've worked with employees, they say, well, the culture, they're responsible for this and they need to do this. And I tell them, look, if you're going to continue to rely on them to change, then we're going to waste our time because we don't have control over that. And there's something about giving it to people that way where they start to realize that they're giving their choice and their agency away by placing change outside of themselves. Like, okay, so things only change when these people change. That means you don't have any power here. You don't have any ability to choose for yourself how you show up. People don't like, once you kind of paint the picture that somebody's taking away their choice. I think people tend to like to choose for themselves, but they freely give it away because it's the easier route. So when you're talking technical things, that's what I do. I mean, that's what I literally say to people.
So that's interesting because it's not like a one-on-one scenario. So I was picturing a one-on-one scenario, but you're talking about a leadership group.
At one-on-one, I'll say the same thing too. Yeah. If I'm working with one leader, coaching them, I'll say, look, if we want to see a certain outcome and we're expecting that outcome is outside of this room with you and me, and it's outside of yourself, then it's never going to happen, right? It might happen, but we'll call it a miracle. Or how are we going to ever replicate that? How are we ever going to be accountable towards that if we're counting on somebody else being the one that needs to do it? And we might be right in the facts that maybe other things or other people need to change, but we can be wrong in thinking that I'm outside of that. So that's the paradox for some people is I can be right in the facts, but wrong in seeing myself as separate from those things, especially when I'm part of the organization.
Well, this is culture of one, right? Like this is what that's what it boils down to. I think what's interesting about this from my perspective is that one of the reasons that my voice is different in the world of burnout is because I don't believe that burnout is only the organizational sort of responsibility, the leadership responsibility. I believe everybody has a responsibility. I tell my clients all the time that nobody's Switzerland, right? Like everybody's influencing the overall culture, like it or not, and for better or for worse. And if it's not for better, then it's not neutral, it's for worse. And so if you are not actively making the culture better in some way, shape, or form, you are actively making the culture worse, even if that's by neglect. And the other piece that I think is so critical that you mentioned here is this idea of like, in the world of short form social media, LinkedIn and Instagram, people are like, well, I can't, burnout is a problem at my office and it's not going to change because we need to change the culture. Bitch, if you're going to be waiting for the culture to change, you're going to be waiting a long time.
Yeah.
That's not going to, I just gave myself a thumbs down, you guys.
Here, let's see if I can.
If you can make it better, right? So I think that there's this idea of agency that I think is really important. Like, do we have to acknowledge that leadership and organizational policies and have influence over us? Sure. Like, we live in an entire country that is not built for our well-being. We don't walk enough. We don't have access to enough vegetables. We have crappy ultra-processed food. Like, that does not support health. And you cannot wait for all of those things to change to take some control over, or at least exert influence where you can over your own life and your own process. Like we looked at our stats at the end of last year, and 80% of the people that we've worked with through their individual burnout recovery processes, 80% of them stayed at their jobs. Right. And I've talked to thousands of people that left their jobs, started a business, went to another business, and guess what all of them have in common? They all burnt out again. because you take your shit with you everywhere you go. So this is, I love this idea of, not because I want individuals to feel full responsibility for anything either. There is this interaction between me and you and us together and the things that we are co-creating on a regular basis. And if we can all take our own part, then we're going to go further faster. So I'm so glad that you said that, because it's like one of my favorite things. You were saying it and I was like, yes.
Yes. The way that you just described burnout, and we'll call it antidote to it. I mean, I'm 100% with you. I feel as though, you know, when I've heard people talk about burnout, and in healthcare, that's a big word.
Huge problem.
And healthcare is incredibly demanding, incredibly transactional.
Yep.
So many regulations. I mean, it's, people are getting burnt out, nurses on the floor. I mean, it's hard work. I would never want to do the work.
And that, is the like, system good? No.
No. And so burnout is a word that they would use all the time. And I would do my best to communicate the same thing that you just did, that it starts with us, right? What we carry with us, our mindset, our mentality towards it. And there's things systematically that we're going to do that hopefully can help. You know, we're going to create purpose here that people can get excited about. And we're going to try to, you know, do things systematically to encourage a different culture, a different dialogue, you know, create a new language, another condition of transformation, a common language that can aid in those things. But nothing is going to be able to force change in an individual. And that's going to come down to you. And so I love that perspective that you have on it. So,
one that we share. All right. So we're getting close to the top of the hour. And what I would love for you to do is tell people who exactly should be reading this book. Give us the title, give us the release date, and then tell us who needs to be reading it, like, right now.
Yeah. Yeah, the caveat was I really struggled with a specific avatar with the publisher and everything when I was writing.
It's hard as hell.
Yeah, but you know, the book is called Beneath the Transaction: Discovering the Seven Conditions That Transform Life and Leadership. And I had a bit of a moral struggle in the subtitle. We took longer to name it. The first one was Discovering the Seven Conditions That Transform Organizations and or people and organizations. And I just felt as though that the big picture of the book, yeah, we're talking about a community, we talk about all these organizational references, but the every story is a personal story. And all the years I've had working with leaders, high level C-suite leaders, elected officials, what have you, and I've seen them go through a transformation, these changes, it always started personally. It always started in their own life. And so I couldn't ignore that life has to be the first part, life and leadership. And so I think that communicates a lot who the audience is. But I would say the audience is more people that are struggling with certain things or curious about certain things. I would say if you're someone that feels stuck, if you're someone that feels like you're just going through the motions and you're lacking purpose, you're lacking something deeper, and then the book's going to be for you. If you feel like your team, your family's stuck, your relationship in a marriage or a family member, what have you, is stuck, I think the book's for you. If you're someone that just innately cares about personal development and growth, and you're seeking to learn more, that then the book's for you. I think that that those are more identifying than an exact sort of person. That I wish I could say, you know, leaders in healthcare. I can't, you know.
No, I think you answered it perfectly.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll stop then from there.
Yeah, I think you answered it perfectly. And then where should people find you and find the book?
Yeah, the book is on, you know, Amazon. It's on all the major retailers, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, pointing people to Amazon specifically right now. And it comes out, released May 19th, but it's available for pre-order right now. You can look at groundworkleadership.org. That's our website. Chris Panetta.me as well can take you there. social media, Facebook, LinkedIn. Just look
all
me up.
All the links
Chris
will be in the notes. We'll
bald
throw
guy
them all
with
in
a
there.
Beard. Instagram, Transform with Chris is my handle. So you can find me, and I love conversations. We have a podcast as well called Beneath the Transaction that my wife and I do. And we're talking again about both life and leadership. So yeah, you can follow us there also.
Love it. Fried fam. The more we have these conversations and the more I'm leaning into this, you know, B2B space really strongly, the more I see and understand and feel and know that every single thing that I did with individuals over the years is really the same exact thing that I'm doing in companies now. And the medicine that I was using with people one-on-one for all these years is the same systems and thought processes that I'm using in companies right now. It's micro scale, macro scale, but it's all the same stuff, right? When we want something to be different, we have to be different. And I hope that you are encouraged today to take a look at Chris's new book, to do a little deep dive about yourself and about what you're contributing to whatever situation you're in, and to decide to make the emotional and cultural soup that we're all swimming in together taste a little better. Until next time. Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.